Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and you find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find more about us and the research that we do by heading over to Instagram and searching our name. As always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Warning: this audio presentation contains graphic details of death, child abuse, and violence. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is Dean Coral, Part 2. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'm your host for tonight. Dean Coral, despite his local reputation in the neighborhood, hid a dark side. In a particularly sick and twisted element to his crimes, he forced some of the boys that he kidnapped and tortured to write postcards to their families, telling them not to worry, that they had found a job in another city, and that they would see them again soon. For many families, however, this didn't make any sense. One of the victims, 15-year-old Billy Ray Lawrence, is a prime example of this. Billy was one of the cool kids. He was tall, handsome, and quite rugged. He liked flannel shirts and was a proper old-school male. That being said, he was also really close to his family and friends. He very rarely went far from home, and was really happy within his small group of close pals and his regular routine. Chrissy Nelson, who we spoke to in the last episode, remembers Billy. Her family knew his, and they were close neighbors.
I think I was the last person to see Billy alive, which still makes me feel sick to this day. A couple of the kids and I were playing in an empty lot at the end of the neighborhood, and I saw Billy. He was a few years older than me, but he always stopped to talk. I'm not sure where he was going, and I didn't ask. I wish I had asked, but when he walked away, I turned around and saw him link up with two guys and walk off with them. I didn't recognize who they were. That was the last time I saw Billy.
Billy was reported missing 2 days later, after his family hadn't seen him, and he had seemingly vanished into thin air. Billy sent a letter to his father around a week later, saying that he had gotten a job and had moved to Austin, Texas. This made absolutely no sense to his family, as Billy had never been to Austin, didn't know anyone in Austin, and he was also still in high school, focused and performing really well. The message seemed to come completely out of nowhere, and it didn't seem like Billy at all. Billy's family immediately knew something was wrong. They smelled foul play right away. As it turns out, Dean Call had forced him to write the letter. The family didn't discover what happened to Billy until almost a year later, however, when Dean Call's torture dungeon was all over the news. Billy was put on a torture board like all of the other victims. A year after the murders emerged, Elmer Wayne Henley received a life sentence for 6 of those murders. That's 6 separate 99-year sentences, to be exact. David Brooks was convicted of only one murder, the strangulation of 15-year-old Billy Ray Lawrence, and he received a life sentence. Wayne Henley continues to apply for parole whenever possible. He calls himself a reformed serial killer. We did try to get an interview with Henley, but the families of the victims objected, so the prison refused him permission to speak to us over the telephone. Henley did tell us in a letter that there were errors within his trial, however, and he doesn't believe he will ever get paroled. But maybe it's safer for him if he stays behind bars, going by what some of the locals of the neighborhood have told us off the record. David Brooks never spoke publicly to the media, and in May 2020, at the age of 65, Brooks died in custody from COVID-19. There was no deathbed confession. You would think that what happened in Houston in 1973 would have alerted society at large that there were sadistic sexual predators amongst us and operating almost unchallenged, hiding in plain sight. The victims all being teenage boys who willingly got in the car with these guys. They knew them. They went to the same school and hung out in the same neighborhood and social groups. But because this was the 1970s, nobody worried about teenage boys. Also, the general public just didn't believe that there was a widespread child abduction problem. Why would they? They had never heard of it. It was outside the comprehension of the norm. But the abductions, torture, and murder of 27 young boys slowly disappeared from the headlines. People began to forget. Dean Corll was dead. Wayne Henley and David Brooks were in prison for the rest of their lives. The public were happy to forget about their evil crimes. It would be more than a decade until Stranger Danger was introduced to the public, and more than 20 years until the public saw it as the real and present threat that it actually was. They would also have to endure countless high-profile crimes and cases in the press until law enforcement took these issues seriously. The fact that there were men out there who took, abused, and murdered young children for nothing more than sexual gratification. And what's more, there were rumors that there were organized networks out there that supported the crime and established groups to perpetuate it entirely under the radar. Now let's fast forward slightly from the murder of Dean Corll to 1975 to be exact. You will remember, in the last episode, we shared information that Wayne Henley had claimed. He said that Dean Corll had told him that he belonged to a United States-wide criminal organization that was based out of Dallas. An organization that Corll called the Foundation, and that traded in young boys and child pornography. The Foundation, Corll told Henley, provided boys for various services to extremely powerful and wealthy individuals across the country. Henley said that this organization was very wealthy and had significant resources at their disposal. Corll claimed that he regularly checked in with the Foundation and its organization's head, known to Henley as the Dallas Boss. The police dismissed it as a crazy story that Henley was told by Corll to install fear in him and possibly control him. Law enforcement had never heard of such crimes before, let alone a national organized crime network, so they heeded no thought to Henley's claim. Then, on February the 17th, 1975, while conducting a routine investigation, the Houston Police Department uncovered a large cache of child pornography, including photographs of young victims and films depicting boys as young as 8. Further, the boys in the films and photos were almost all from the Houston Heights neighborhood. There were 16 young boys identified in the pornography images and films, and 11 of the individuals were among Corll's known victims. Their identities, by this point, had been largely established, so the police knew exactly who they were. The discovery caused significant concern amongst the Houston Police Department, who chose not to reveal the discovery to the general public, for fear of widespread concern and panic. But what the police department were even more concerned about was the disturbing possibility that the statements Dean Corll had given to Wayne Henley, in that he was associated with a Dallas-based national organization which, quote-unquote, bought and sold boys, may indeed have held a degree of truth. The police raid seized a card filing system containing around 10,000 names of clients across North America who were part of the network, and also the details of numerous teenage boys exploited by the sex trafficking ring. The discovery of the material eventually led to the arrest of 5 individuals in Santa Clara, California. Roy Ames was one of those men arrested. He was a known producer of child pornography and owns a warehouse full of the stuff which he distributed. Dean Corll actually had his business card in his wallet at the time of his death, which was one of the ways police were able to track him down. Law enforcement were horrified that there were enough customers out there across the country to justify the need for a warehouse full of stock for distribution. The Houston Police Department chose not to pursue any possible link between Roy Ames and the Dean Corll killings, however. They stated that they felt the victims of Corll and their families had suffered enough. which is fairly staggering considering who they had found and what it could have possibly meant. And if this wasn't crazy enough, this occurred after an August the 15th, 1973 investigation in Dallas had uncovered a nationwide homosexual procurement ring operated by a man named John David Norman. That's right, this happened in the week after the Dean Call murders were uncovered. A nationwide child trafficking organization was hinted at by Call as being run by a man in Dallas, and then a man in Dallas was arrested and discovered to be doing just that. Yet law enforcement established no link between the two. Another investigation that was carried out in Homewood, Illinois in October of 1973 discovered thousands of index cards that had been stored in tiny drawers in old-fashioned wooden filing cabinets. It was a month earlier where law enforcement had found index cards in another apartment in Dallas. Both locations and both sets of index cards were the property of one John David Norman. The Dallas search had led to the Illinois search, and both locations turned up the same worrying evidence. So let's talk about John David Norman. Not many people are aware of him, and what's even more rare is that his name is hardly ever spoken about today in true crime circles. Yet he was a man who spent over 40 years trafficking boys across America. He was a grade A apex predator. John David Norman was born on the 13th of October 1927 in Ada, Oklahoma. Norman moved to the Northside neighborhood of Houston with his family in 1943. Northside is the neighborhood that sits directly north of the Heights in Houston. Norman began work as a radio engineer at the age of 16 for KTRH, a local radio station. His plan was to save up enough money so that he could attend Northwestern University. But I guess life got in the way, as this never happened. Norman was a prolific pedophile and sex offender, convicted numerous times between 1960 and 1998 on charges of child molestation and child pornography. Although records of arrests for similar offences date all the way back to 1954, though he was not charged formally this early. Norman was the chief operator of several direct mail-in services for pornographic literature and films, and also child trafficking organizations. Some of these networks were the Odyssey Foundation, based out of Dallas, the Delta Project, Creative Corp, MC Publications, which he ran out of Chicago, and Handy Andy, which he ran from Pennsylvania. We'll talk more about these organizations shortly. In August of 1973, a 25-year-old gay rights activist named Charles Brizendine from West Virginia began a new job with the Odyssey Foundation in Dallas, Texas. The man who hired Brizendine was 45-year-old Alan Hitchcock. Hitchcock was an alias for John David Norman. According to the Odyssey Foundation's literature and a 1976 FBI report, the foundation was set up to, quote, give deserving but underprivileged young men the opportunity to associate with adults interested in giving them a boost in life. It sounds very vague and by today's standards particularly suspect, right? Well, almost immediately, Charles Brizendine realized that the Odyssey Foundation wasn't what he thought. The young men were underage, and the adult sponsors, who the literature for the organization stated were supposed to be giving them a boost in life, were only interested in buying time and services from the boys and sexually molesting them. It was an organized pedophile network. Brizendine was a gay rights activist, not a pedophile. He wanted nothing to do with the organization. Further, after reading about the Houston mass murders and the reports of Dean Corll and Corll's two accomplices claiming that Dean worked for an organization in Dallas that bought and sold and murdered boys, Brizendine started to connect the dots. Brizendine found photos of boys in the Odyssey files and details about where they were from that matched the location of Dean Corll's murders. In a panic, Brizendine called the FBI and they contacted the Dallas police. So, just 6 days after law enforcement opened Dean Corll's boat shed in Houston, Dallas police raided the Odyssey Foundation. John David Norman was arrested. Norman was sending kids around the country for prostitution. It was an organization that provided kids for rent. $40 per day plus any airfare. The kids were often runaways or street kids, so no one would miss them or care what they were up to or where they were going, Norman assumed. Norman would also place ads in gay magazines and cruise around bus stations, gaming arcades, and parks where homeless kids gathered late at night to find boys. A lot of the boys were desperate for food and money, so they believed Norman's bullshit when it came to him providing some kind of reasoning for his actions. The Dallas police confiscated a truck full of pornographic literature from Norman's apartment following the raid. In addition to cameras and other photography equipment, stationery and a typewriter. But the most significant item seized as evidence was the one thing that showed the true scope of the nationwide organization: the membership index cards. On the index cards were names of average family men, prominent and well-known politicians, famous musicians and media personalities, successful businessmen, religious and civic leaders, and other names in positions of power. The index cards had the name, address, and phone numbers of each of the members of the organization. The cards also logged the members' preferred services, things such as oral sex, anal sex, role play, photography, group sex, and so on. Most of the cards also stipulated the type of quote-unquote unique product that the member preferred. Products being an age range, hair and eye color, color of skin and level of body hair, etc. One of the Dallas detectives who made the raid on Norman's apartment and who viewed the index cards had this to say, quote,
"I saw the cards. There were thousands of them. One card per customer. It was sickening to read. But as you flicked through all of them, what stood out the most is the names. You started to recognize some of them, then more and more, and before you knew it, you realized that an awful lot of the members were very powerful and wealthy men. For me, the most earth-shaking moment was when I found the name of a very well-known musical artist, a singer from a band that I was particularly fond of. The singer was married and had children. I was floored to read on the card his sexual preferences and previous orders. These weren't just a bunch of street people. I mean, these were people who could afford the Fly Kids, from Houston to Atlanta, and from Atlanta to New York, and again, prominent people, not just your everyday Joe."
Every name on those cards would have required its own investigation, a nationwide effort that no one seemed willing to make or had an appetite to attempt. As for the Dallas Police Department, they acknowledged that it would have been impossible for them to do it, so they didn't. So what happened to the cards with all of those names? The Dallas Police Department admitted following a 2017 Freedom of Information request that they went missing less than a year after they were seized from John Norman's apartment. So, what happened to John Norman? Well, in a nutshell, Norman posted $7,000 bail, then fled Texas. Not exactly the behavior of an innocent man. But just 2 months after John Norman's Boys for Rent scheme in Dallas was raided and uncovered, the police in Homewood, Illinois, received an anonymous phone call. Now, Homewood is about 30 miles south of Chicago. Well, the anonymous phone call was from a woman calling from an apartment building where she reported that a man was luring young boys to his apartment and performing sexual acts upon them. The caller identified one of these boys as a 13-year-old Kenny Hellstrom. Hellstrom's father was close friends with the very same detective who happened to receive the anonymous call, so he immediately called the boy's father and requested that him and his son come in to talk with him. Kenny revealed right away what had been happening to him and told Detective Flannery, the detective in question, everything. He told how he had met this friendly man in a restaurant in Homewood, and the man asked him if he wanted a ride home, and he said sure. So Kenny got in the car, but instead of taking him home, the man took him to his apartment and asked him if he wanted some beer. Nothing else happened that day, Kenny said. After the beer, the man just took Kenny home. But Kenny, of course, like most 13-year-old boys, are going to do what most 13-year-old boys do, and he went back and told all of his friends, "Hey, I know a good place where we can get free beer." And with that, Kenny said, is how it all got started. The friendly man would give Kenny and his friends beer, then show them pornographic films featuring only males performing sexual acts on one another. The boys, although they thought it was weird, just went along with it. Things quickly escalated, and the visits progressed into alcohol-filled group sex between the man and all of the boys. Each of the boys, four of them in total, all shared entirely similar and detailed accounts of the events as part of their witness testimonies, which were submitted to police. The man in question, the friendly man, was John David Norman, an evil and manipulative piece of human garbage who showed no remorse for his actions, and he knew entirely that what he was doing was completely wrong and considered one of the worst crimes that a man could possibly commit. Yet he did it anyway. Detective Flannery and his team raided the apartment of John Norman and amassed significant evidence against him. It wouldn't be long before they also identified that Norman had absconded from Dallas, committing a federal offense with interstate flight to avoid prosecution. During the raid, as well as photography and filmmaking equipment, illegal pornography and various literature of an obscene nature, the police also found over 2,000 index cards with the names of more than 1,000 boys used for trafficking purposes and around 2,000 clients of Norman's who used the boys. The boys' names on the cards were aged between 8 to 20 years of age. In the 2 months since John Norman had fled from Dallas to Homewood, he had reset up his organization and already had 1,000 boys and had reconnected with more than 2,000 of his wealthy clients. In fact, the police later established that the apartment that Norman was staying in and running his enterprise from was actually owned by one of those wealthy clients, Charles Railing. Railing, who absconded to Europe with a 16-year-old boy that Norman had provided, never to be seen in the United States again. As for the index cards with the details of all the potential perpetrators, well, law enforcement identified that some of Norman's illegal activities had gone on in the city of Chicago itself and involved missing boys from Chicago. So the Chicago Police Department's Juvenile Division requested the index cards to analyze and look into criminal activity. But what happened to those cards? Do they exist today? It has emerged that the cards disappeared sometime in 1975 from the Chicago Police Department. Norman was kept in Chicago's Cook County Jail with bail set at $325,000, something he couldn't cover. None of his customers were charged or investigated yet again, however. So that's two cases, back to back, 2 months apart, where police uncovered a national sex trafficking ring run by the same man, where none of his clients were charged, and on both occasions his client list had vanished shortly after their discovery. Some would call that suspicious. In fact, even Detective Flannery, who was involved in the arrest and investigation into John Norman at the time, had this to say, quote,
"Power. The people on those cards ran a lot of things. They were rich and powerful. Politicians, business leaders, religious leaders, celebrities. It's not so much of a stretch to see why and how those cards disappeared. People like you and me would have been investigated and in jail a long time ago, but these people, they do it and they get away with it."
In 1976, John David Norman was sentenced to 4 years in Pontiac Prison. Kenny Hallstrom was the star witness for the prosecution, and it was his witness testimony that put Norman away. Just 4 months after Norman's incarceration on the 19th of January 1977, someone murdered Kenny Hallstrom. He was stabbed to death while walking home from work. No one was ever charged with the killing. There were rumors that John Norman had arranged the murder from prison, but this could never be proven. Although, there is information worth considering here. While in the Cook County Jail awaiting trial, John Norman met 20-year-old Philip Paskey from Chicago. Paskey was inside awaiting trial on attempted murder during a robbery. Paskey and Norman became very close friends while inside the jail. They shared particular interests and tastes, shall we say. Then in early 1976, Philip Paskey was paroled and continued to run Norman's Boys for Rent operation from the outside. Get this. Norman's good friend and now business associate Philip Paskey was also an employee of PDM Contractors after he left jail. PDM Contractors was the company owned and ran by, yep, John Wayne Gacy. Now, Gacy actually implicated Paskey, Norman, and two other PDM employees as his accomplices in murder after he had been convicted. Gacy stated that Paskey pimped out boys for sex or homemade movies. Gacy also claimed in a 1992 interview that John Norman and the Delta Project were producing snuff films of young boys, which also included a number of Gacy's victims. In fact, two of Gacy's victims, Kenneth Parker and Michael Marino, had last been seen alive in the vicinity of John Norman's home. Gacy's claims at the time were dismissed in the media, although law enforcement knew and had evidence that what he was saying was true. John Norman didn't stop what he was doing, though. He was arrested again in Chicago in the fall of 1978 after he moved opposite a boys' home and was discovered abusing several of the teenage inhabitants of the home, vulnerable young kids. Once again, following Norman's arrest, several thousand index cards were seized containing the names of his clients. And shortly after, that's right, they disappeared. He was released again 2 years later and crisscrossed the United States running his organization and attempting to avoid detection and prosecution. Denver, Pennsylvania, Missouri, and back to Illinois. Everywhere he went, he was caught, skipped bail, and went on the run again. Each time, suspiciously, his client lists always disappeared or were destroyed. In fact, we know that the mysterious vanishing of John Norman's documents went right to the top. We know this as between October 1983 and May 1984, John Norman created child porn literature, which he titled Handy Andy. Norman distributed it from Asper's in Pennsylvania, where he owned a rural home which was paid for by a kindly donator. The Handy Andy publication involved the exploitation of more than 20 young boys between the ages of 12 to 16 years of age. The literature that Norman distributed was done so alongside his national trafficking network, which he remained focused on. Norman's home was raided on the 31st of May 1984, but Norman once again had fled the state following a tip-off from unknown persons that the raid was imminent. Norman was eventually apprehended in Bolingbrook, Illinois in October of 1984, though he was released on bail in March of 85 and fled once again. During the May 1984 raid, once again, law enforcement discovered a large quantity of index cards containing the names of several thousand customers from across the United States. Instead of turning the index cards over to the FBI, the police in Aspers sent the index card evidence to the State Department in Washington, D.C. for further investigation. The federal agency had formally requested the items following news of their discovery following the raid. The Aspers Police Department figured that due to the amount of names in the index card system, that it would take federal resources to investigate all of the names and a huge task force would need to be put in place to investigate each of them. But after around a year, Aspers Police Department heard nothing more about the evidence, so they sent a formal request for update. The response they received by letter stated, quote, "Thank you for your inquiry. After extensive review of the evidence, we didn't find any passport violations, and so the evidence was subsequently destroyed in their entirety." Unquote. The letter from the State Department to Aspers Police is actually in the public record and can be viewed via Aspers Police Department. Could the fact that prominent politicians and federal employees held in the index card system have had anything to do with such a strange reaction and response? I'll let you decide on that one for yourself. So what does any of this actually mean? Well, if nothing else, John David Norman's organization and his links to Dean Corll and John Wayne Gacy, two prolific serial killers who focused their crimes on young boys, it shows that the organization that Norman ran held murderers within its client list. A list of people who were seemingly protected by men in positions of significant power and control. It tells us that for many decades, children were trafficked and abused by these men, and in some instances killed and disposed of, then these crimes covered up at some of the highest levels of power. In 1999, John Norman was declared a sexually violent predator by the state of California. He was committed to Atascadero State Mental Hospital. Whilst Norman was released from Atascadero in October 2008, he was recommitted a short time later after he handed a sexually suggestive note to a teenage male grocery store clerk in El Centro, Southern California. This time, Norman was sent to Coalinga State Hospital in March of 2009. His sentence was an indefinite stay. Coalinga is controversial amongst some, as the hospital is said to be able to contain paedophiles indefinitely until the hospital staff no longer deem the inmate a risk to the public. For those of you who are interested, the British documentary filmmaker Louis Theroux produced a film about the inmates at the facility in 2009. It's titled, quote, A Place for Paedophiles. No promo, but it's available on BBC iPlayer and dailymotion.com for those who want to check it out. Trigger warning though, it is a tough watch. John David Norman died at Coalinga State Hospital 2 years following his incarceration in May 2011. On the 9th of May 1994, John Wayne Gacy was transferred to Stateville Correctional Center to be executed the following day. Following his last requested meal of a KFC family bucket, French fries, a dozen fried shrimp, fresh strawberries and a Diet Coke, John Wayne Gacy was executed by lethal injection at 12:58 a.m. His last words were, quote, kiss my ass, unquote. Whilst David Brooks died in May of 2020 from COVID-19, Elmer Wayne Henley remains incarcerated at the Stiles Prison Unit in Jefferson County, Southeast Texas. At the time of writing this episode, he is 68 years old. Whilst most of these men are dead, almost all of the names in Norman's index card system have gotten away with significant crimes for decades. What makes you think this has ever stopped? Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.